Matt, thanks so much for that introduction. You bring back memories of 25 years ago. Back in Maxwell Air Force Base, I first met Matt and indeed John Warden, because it was his period of command, and Gary Mo Morgan, remember him, sadly died since, designer of Flight Leader. So these things echo down the decades. A wonderful introduction. Thank you, Matt. Okay, I'm going to start us off talking, as you can see, about dilemmas and trade-offs, because the more I think about war games and war game design, the more central this element seems to me to be. Let me just illustrate from the field of game theory, not something that many of us engage with, but it's very much the application of gaming techniques to strategic studies problems and economic problems, and of course dilemmas being central to that, the classic one being the prisoner's dilemma there. So wargaming, really, the value of wargaming, the essential of wargaming, it seems to me, really revolves around this notion of dilemmas and trade-offs. If it were easy, it wouldn't be very interesting to wargame it. If you could easily see what to do, a computer can make that decision. It's where you're agonizing over what to do, that's where the decision element within wargaming of all sorts of different kinds comes in. So I'm going to use that as the central thread to my remarks about design. And I'll do so through four quick subsections. First of all, dilemmas faced by designers. And all of these will be familiar to you. Really, I'm just running through so that I'm ordering the knowledge rather than suggesting I'm making great new contributions, just so that you have a framework, perhaps, within which to think about these issues. Modelling real-world dilemmas. We're all modellers. We're trying to capture elements of the real world. How to incorporate dilemmas for the players within the games that you design. And I think, crucially, how to discover unknown dilemmas through the process of wargame design and wargame execution. Okay, so let me say a little bit about each of those in turn. First of all, the dilemmas faced by designers. Perhaps the most fundamental, do you want rules or not? And of course, way back in the 19th century, free versus rigid Kriegspiel, the variants which got rid of all the old rules and just had the umpires making things up as they go along, that remains with us today. The full spectrum there, there's Tom, of course, running his war game, which has no rules, written rules, just the map and the counters, and everything else is in the head of the umpires, all the way through to hobby games, typically, which are the full rigid extreme and can be run by the players themselves without the designer ever having to be there, as long as they can convey their ideas effectively in the rules, which of course is a big proviso, but there we are. And everywhere in between. Okay. So, how far do you want to systematize the rules so you don't need a knowledgeable umpire or yourself present to run the game? Open versus concealed information. The picture shows a playtest of an early version of the Camberley Kriegspiel. The chap with his back to you there standing up is General John Dvenkovich, co-designer of ours, and Gary Bourne also there. What it's illustrating, of course, is the classic three-room war game, or in this case we only had one room, but they had people's backs to each other. Each side only knowing what its own forces are doing and what intelligence is provided to it. The classic Kriegspiel approach. All the way to an open table, single table, both players, all the players clustering around it, everyone can see everything. The chess analogy, of course, with complete explicit information. How do you want to approach that particular trade-off? Where on that spectrum do you want to place your design? Detail versus abstraction. There's an Eastern Front game, the old style, I'm not sure which one, but you can get the point about the number of counters. There's part of a modern coin game in which there's a great deal of abstraction. There's a lot fewer pieces on the board. Some people, of course, though, would say, well, it's a bit too abstract, a bit too gamey. I can't actually see the physics of what's going on, and I can't relate to what this counter or this token means, and so on. So how do you want to strike that balance, that trade-off? Linked to that, complexity versus accessibility. The real world is an inordinately complex place. Any kind of complete model of that would be unplayably complex. It would be the real world, in effect. How far do you dumb down your model of the real world in order to make it accessible? The illustration shows a game that I designed very much at the accessible end so that I could play it. We did it in the previous connections, just with one side of rules, which you give to people, explain to them, then they run the game for themselves, having never seen it before. That's the ultimate in perhaps accessibility, but the sacrifices in terms of the simplicity that is required are very, very great, so that you can see where the trade-offs are coming. Manual versus computer, something we're particularly exploring in this conference. Both have their advantages, the automation within the manual, the design accessibility, sorry, within the computer, the design accessibility within the manual. Again, which do you want to go for, costs and benefits and so on. And luck versus skill. Not an easy one, because simulation would sometimes require a set significant emphasis on luck. There's a war game some of you may be familiar with, B-17 Queen of the Skies, and in one sense at least, it's a very good simulation in that the players have almost no agency. They're just hoping they don't get shot down by the flak and so on. That's a very good simulation. People like to do it as an experience game. It doesn't really get you much into the decision element of wargaming. Okay. The other point about luck is a very simple way of abstracting things. You can write very simple rules. I mean, I can give you a war game for the Second World War. Roll a die. If you get a one, the Axis win. If you get 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, the Allies win. Okay? You can have all sorts of debates about where you should set that line, but it's a very simple game because you've abstracted everything through luck. You try and model all the factors underpinning it and put them in the game. It's a very complex game, albeit it could then be more skill-based. Anyway, so there's just a quick run-through of the many different trade-offs that designers make in setting up the context of their design. And there are others as well. So moving on. Modelling dilemmas in the real world. When you're trying to incorporate the dilemma element into war games, the first thing to do is to say, what dilemmas do the real combatants face, the real decision makers? Because that's what you want to reflect, rather than introducing artificial dilemmas just for the sake of artificial gameplay. And of course, you don't need to look very far to find what these dilemmas are. I'm going to use as illustrations the Second World War, because it's still the greatest war there has ever been and hopefully ever will be, and it's certainly the focus of the great majority, or the majority, of published war games, simply because of its enormity. Let me just use that to illustrate some of these real-world dilemmas. Perhaps the most pervasive is prioritization. We never have enough, and therefore we always need to think, where can we do with a bit less in order that we have enough in the key places? That's not just true of forces, of course, it's true of logistics, it's true of command resources. It was brought out in the mega game yesterday. The game I've used to illustrate here is a game, Race to the Rhine, focusing on logistics and the period of the breakout and pursuit from Normandy and the problem of the Red Ball Express and the carriage of fuel and so on, Patton versus Montgomery and the like. So where do you put your priorities in the situation of resource scarcity, pervasive throughout pretty much all situations? Do you attack or do you defend? There's advantages and disadvantages to both of them. I've chosen the period in mid-1943 on the Eastern Front, when both sides face that dilemma. There's a stalemate. Do you actually try and take the initiative, as the Germans did at Kursk, or do you wait, let the enemy attack you and exhaust themselves and then counterattack them? Okay. Key classic dilemma within war. Concentration versus dispersion. This is my game from my simulating war book of a British battalion attack in the Second World War, fire and movement. And one of the points that design focuses on is, in order to try to break through an enemy line at optimum defensive dispersal, you need to concentrate to get sufficient forces. But by concentrating, you expose yourself to enemy firepower. So there's a trade-off. How do you strike that balance? You can't have the best of both worlds. That's the essence of a dilemma. This is something that writers like Lutwak talk about enormously in his book Strategy, that war is different from most of the things that we do in life, except for games, because there is an active opponent who is trying to frustrate you. Trying to outwit that opponent means you do some rather strange things. In the normal world, if you asked when would be a good occasion to drive a big heavy tank, it wouldn't be through deep snow in the middle of the Ardennes forest. But on two occasions, the Germans did attack through the Ardennes forest, and on the second occasion, the Battle of the Bulge, of course, they did it in the middle of winter. Why? Because they're trying to get surprise and conceal themselves from their opponents with air superiority and so on and so forth. So in war, you do very inefficient things in order to be unpredictable and to surprise the opponent. And there's a classic dilemma: where do you strike the balance between those two objectives? Same campaign just earlier, boldness versus caution, the classic war game illustration of that, of course, the Market Garden campaign. Do you go at the big risk-taking, high-stakes gamble like the attack at Arnhem, or do you play it safe with a broad front approach and not be able to end the war by Christmas? Okay. How risk-taking are you? Do you feel lucky? Inherent trade-offs, costs and benefits. With armour, for example, the trade-off between firepower, protection and mobility. You need to give in some areas in order to get the benefits in others. The example I've given is something I've been staring at for far too long this summer. It's a performance graph for a World War II fighter, and drawing out the trade-off when you look at it and understand it, between angles and energy. Basically, when you're turning in an aircraft, the tighter your turn, the more energy you expend per degree that you turn. That means when you're in a dogfight, you have a choice between turning and keeping the enemy in front of you, but losing energy relative to him, or having him behind you, but at least you've got more energy, more altitude, more speed, and so on. Classic trade-off: you can't have the best of both worlds, at least within a single aircraft. And finally, cooperation versus self-interest. Even in a war like the Second World War with opposed blocs such as they were, especially towards the end, you're getting tensions between allies. You get tensions between generals like Zhukov and Konev attacking Berlin. You get tensions, of course, between the West and the East over the post-war order. There are games like this one in which the opponents are nominally allies who are fighting each other for the spoils of the disintegrating German Empire. And this, of course, builds into the classic non-zero-sum games of the game theorists, prisoner's dilemma, and so on and so forth. Okay. So World War II illustrates, through these sorts of games, the many dilemmas which are there in the real world. We don't need to invent them in order to import them into our games. Okay, how can we incorporate the dilemmas for the players? A few techniques and a few ways in which those dilemmas become operational to the players. One obvious thing: you need to provide options. If you make the game run on rails, there are no decisions to be made because you've closed them off. You need to provide options for the players. Here are some BA students playing my Hell's Gate game. And there's all sorts of different things they can do, different ways to go. Some don't make much sense, but you can do them, and others are very difficult to decide between for reasons I'll come to in a second. But you have to provide those options. Secondly, you need to force prioritization. If you allow people to do everything in the game, they will do everything. In reality, that is probably not achievable. This is a test of the RCAT system in my office with two of the veterans, Julian Thompson and Mike Clapp. And one element of this and of other systems is you can't just move everything every turn, as you can actually, unrealistically, in many war games. You need to put operations points, command points, or whatever. And therefore, you need to choose, do I do this or do I do that, not how do I just move all my forces magically all at the same time. So forcing prioritization to reflect that first dilemma I talked about. And creating tensions between objectives. Everyone wants to have the best of both worlds. You need, as a designer, to make them face these choices. This is from the war game that we did in Wynne referred to with the missile defense game. This is the first one, the Baltic scenario, and we took full advantage of the fact that Kaliningrad is stuck behind NATO territory, and similarly the Baltic states are stuck behind Kaliningrad. Both sides had objectives to protect their territory, despite the fact that it's almost behind enemy lines, but they're also trying to avoid nuclear war. It's very difficult to do both. Very simple to do one or the other, but it's not easy to achieve both objectives. And in the game, they actually failed in both because they blew up the world. But it's through creating tensions. Don't take the easy path, which is always, okay, let's not have a war then, because you know it's nobody's interest. Let me just say something about how these dilemmas operationalize themselves to the players. I think this is perhaps the most important things to take away. Dilemmas due to incalculability. Chess is a very good example of this, despite being a completely open game. Computers, of course, can work through all the possibilities. That's where they can now beat us. It's very difficult for certainly average people to work through all the many, many options that are available and which is going to give them the best outcome. That's an example of sheer incalculability in the limits of the human brain. Many games make it too easy and you can work out, oh, well, the optimum approach is this, so I'll just do that. There's no dilemma, obviously, you see. So you need to have a system which is complex enough, unreadable enough, that the game becomes, at least to some degree, incalculable for the players. So they don't automatically work out, this is the best plan, regardless of what the enemy does. That leads me to the second one, dilemmas due to uncertainty. Uncertainty due to the roll of the die is not necessarily helping you here, because people can calculate. If there's a 1/6 chance of losing 3 points, that's, on average, minus a half, yeah? Sometimes they'll be unlucky, sometimes they'll be lucky, but it's still an obvious choice to make in relation to others. When you don't know what the enemy will do, and it's second-guessing and so on, then that becomes much more uncertain, and this is the very simple Schlieffen game I talked about earlier, which uses that principle of limited information, double-blind, and so on, to introduce the dilemmas which flow from not having perfect information about this enemy situation and so on. And the third one is something we don't talk about enough, but I think it's fundamental. Dilemmas due to incommensurability. There's something about war games which inescapably does not model the real world. In the real world, the choices that people face are incommensurable. They are apples versus oranges. You can't weigh them up against one another and come to an obvious conclusion. And that's illustrated here. People are putting their lives on the line. How much is the life of a soldier worth? In terms of territory gained or whatever it might be. These are apples and oranges. In the war games, everything can be reduced to victory or defeat. Victory points for this, victory points for that. It might be different, but they all come down to a common currency. And if you're not careful, you can work out what's the best way to maximize your profit, do you see? So this deserves a lot of thinking about, it seems to me, this one of incommensurability, because rightly, war games don't involve people putting their lives on the line, but that creates inescapable artificialities in modelling a very important real-world dilemma between blood, treasure, national glory, prestige, and so on and so forth. Very difficult to weigh up in one common balance. Okay, very quickly, discovering unknown dilemmas. War games have the potential to reveal to us things that as designers we hadn't thought of. Just a couple of examples. When you do the playtests, people will make unexpected choices. So, for example, in a war game that we played in my MA class, a student designed one on the Wilderness Campaign, a very big picture of the Wilderness Campaign in 1864, and the players just went round the wilderness. And he said, but that's not supposed to happen. But hang on, why? Why didn't they? It seems obvious. What have I missed? The play revealing that there must have been trade-offs and so on which were not modelled in his initial game. And the second one, my favourite example, and this comes out best often from free systems rather than ones where you codify the options within the rules, eliciting creative challenges. What people are trying to do in the real world is to put the enemy on the horns of a dilemma. So they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. And here's a sort of free play war game. You can see several people, including Gary Bourne and Tom, of course, there. The episode it reminds me of is one of Tom's stories where they're testing little robot tanks, the idea of having little robot tanks for with machine guns on for urban warfare. But the other side in the game said, OK, we'll get the street kids to go and try and put a blanket over and bring these things back. Then the decision bounces back to the side with the tanks. Are you going to shoot these kids to protect your crewless little tanks? Oh, shit. No, we can't, can we? Because we can't justify that because we haven't got any of our lives at risk. And they couldn't work it. You see, that's the way in which a war game can reveal to you dilemmas that you might face that you hadn't thought of, and otherwise you might have built the things and actually faced that dilemma for real. Okay, so the conclusion. Dilemmas, it seems to me, are central to wargaming. The decision element of wargaming focuses upon these dilemmas. They exist in the real world. They exist for the designers. It's hard to translate them into the game. They don't come about automatically. And in some ways, particularly the incommensurability, war games actually are not the best reflection of real world dilemmas. And we need to think carefully. But if we can manage that, a great deal of the design challenge is cracked. Thank you very much.